4.6 billion.
The Earth forms.
Cambrian.
542 million.
Complex life explodes.
Permian Triassic.
251 million.
90% of species die.
Cretaceous Tertiary.
65 million.
Meteor kills the dinosaurs.
55 million.
Primates appear.
2.3 million.
Pleistocene.
200,000.
Humans appear.
20,000.
Agricultural
250.
Revolution. Industrial Revolution.
60.
Great Acceleration.
The Anthropocene.
Welcome to Generation Anthropocene. I'm your host, Mike Osborne. Today's interview is with Catherine Hayhoe at Texas Tech University. Before we get to that interview, though, we're joined in studio today with Maxine Luckett.
Thanks for having me today.
I'm glad you were able to come in. How's your break?
It's just ending now, and it wasn't long enough, as usual.
So the person who interviewed Catherine Hayhoe is actually Jeremy Caves. He recently did the Richard Alley interview, and Jeremy is also with us in studio. Hi, Jeremy.
Hi, Mike.
I want to ask why you wanted to interview Catherine. What was the hook? What was the allure? Why go after this interview?
Well, Catherine's a really interesting person for two reasons. One, just academically, she's a fantastic scientist. She's served on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. She knows her stuff about regional climate modeling, which is sort of one of the cutting edge fields in climate change science.
Now, you didn't talk to her about any of this, right?
No. The reason, I wish I had. But one of the other reasons she's a fascinating person is that she's a very outspoken Christian evangelical. And as such, that gives her a very interesting perspective, both as a scientist and a very religious person. And in fact, she just recently wrote a book about climate change science for Christian evangelicals. And the reason for this book, and this is the really interesting part, is that her husband is both a linguistic professor and a preacher in Lubbock. And when they first married, she didn't know that her husband was a climate denier. So after they're married, she discovers this and over the course of several years convinces him that what she's doing as a scientist is really valid.
You don't see a lot of scientists talking about
God
all that much.
She made a good point. She was talking about how they're not necessarily welcome because of what they do. If you've ever felt that way, I mean, it might be an awkward question to ask you about religious beliefs.
Yeah,
but
you're a religious Jew.
Yeah.
You're Jewish.
I'm Jewish. I would not say I'm particularly religious, and I certainly don't get the vibe that people in my department or in the entire school are religious. Mm-hmm. At the same time, my girlfriend is quite religious.
Really?
Yeah, and she's actually the one who set up that whole Adam and Eve question in the Anthropocene.
Wow.
I love that question. I have to give her credit for giving me that idea.
One
thing Catherine said after our interview ended is her book isn't selling terribly well. And that's because it's been blacklisted by the right-wing media system. They see it as attacking their conception of climate change, and it's coming from the inside, right? So therefore, it has to get blacklisted. And it's really too bad.
Jeremy, thanks for coming into the studio, and let's get to the interview.
Hey, thanks.
I'm Jeremy, and I'm here with Dr. Catherine Hayhoe, who is a professor of atmospheric sciences at Texas Tech, but in the political science department, and also recently co-authored a book with her husband called A Climate for Change, Global Warming Facts for Faith-Based Decisions. So welcome, Catherine.
Thanks.
So I wanted to begin this interview with your qualifications as a well-known climate science communicator. The fact that when you met your husband, you didn't realize that he was a climate skeptic, but you've since convinced him that climate change is real and an important issue. And I wanted to start by asking, how did you do this?
Well, I have to add that he didn't actually know I was studying climate science either, because
Okay. We
met when you're in grad school. And you know, when you're in grad school, you're kind of like, you know, oh, my computer crashed and I lost 100 lines of code, or, oh, I'm having problems with this chapter of my thesis. And I was working specifically on the chemistry of non-CO2 greenhouse gases. So, you know, it was a little bit into the weeds. So it wasn't until after we got married that we figured out that we were on opposite sides of the fence. And I honestly don't know who was more surprised, him or me.
Wow.
Yeah.
So was it hard to convince him that what you do is valid science?
Well, it was hard in that he had grown up in a culture where the issue of climate change was associated with, you know, liberal tree hugging and an ideology that he felt was completely foreign and unpalatable to him. But I think the fact that we were married gave us a great basis to start from, because we both had a mutual respect for each other. And I think that's what's so often lacking, is that when we come across someone who doesn't think that climate change is real, we do not respect them. We immediately judge them. We say, well, they're an idiot. But I knew my husband. I knew he was a really smart person. And so I knew that he had to have good reasons for believing what he did. Otherwise, he wouldn't. And I really think that that helped, because he had the same feeling for me.
And I should add, he's also a pastor and a professor of linguistics at Texas Tech.
That's right. And he's also a Christian author. He writes a lot of books about practical theology.
And so the two of you, as I said in the introduction, the two of you have written a book about global warming and the facts behind global warming, and it's geared towards Christian conservatives?
It is. In fact, the book is actually dedicated to everyone who thinks climate change isn't real. The book came about after, you know, my husband and I, it took us probably about 2 years to kind of talk through the issue of climate change. It wasn't something we hit on every day. But, you know, every week or two, he'd say, hey, you know, I heard this. What about this? And so it was really about 2 years before we got to the point where he said, you know what? This just really makes sense. For him, it was kind of like Occam's razor. It got to the point where the simplest answer was that climate really was changing. And humans really were to blame, because otherwise the conspiracy theories that you would have to believe in, that all of NASA was involved in some massive cover-up to fake all the temperature data, and not only fake the temperature data, but fake the bloom dates of all the trees around the world and the geographic extent of all the insects and the rate at which the glaciers are melting. He got to the point where that was a lot more difficult to believe, that all of that was completely fabricated, than to believe that actually it really was happening. Then he started getting a lot of questions and sometimes even some flack from his friends and family, because they would say, oh, you know, climate change, whatever, whatever. And he'd say, well, actually, it really is. And they'd say, what? So often they had some new argument, like, you know, haven't you heard that the ice caps on Mars are melting too? So obviously it has to just be a natural cycle, or isn't this just some Al Gore thing? So he would come home with questions, really good questions often, that we would then talk about and find answers to. And so after a couple years of doing that, and especially after moving to Texas, where he started to get all these questions from the people in his church, from our neighbors and from our friends, after a few years of that, we started to look around and say, well, is there some kind of resource we can point people to? Because we feel like we're answering the same questions now again and again. How do we know it's not a natural cycle or the sun? It's freezing outside. Where is global warming now? Or even from a Christian perspective, how could God let something like this happen? So we started to look around to try to find a resource we could give people. But what we found is that there's a lot of great resources out there. But at that time, all of the resources started from the premise that you were on board with the science. But none of it started from the premise that you don't think this is a real problem. So kind of by default, we started to think, well, maybe we should write our own book together, because this doesn't exist. And then what my husband did was, he was in charge of watching all of the videos and the movies and going to all the blog sites that said that climate change wasn't real. I started to try to do it myself, but after watching just one movie, I got so angry, I was just about chewing holes out of the carpet. So I said, I just cannot take this. You have to do it. So he watched all of those, and he made a list of what he thought were the things that we had to talk about. So he basically outlined the book and said, these are the things that we need to talk about, because these are the myths that people are believing. You know, isn't it global cooling now instead of global warming? Won't it ruin the economy to do something about climate change? And so in some cases, the things he said we had to talk about, I said, well, are you sure? Like, people really think that? And he said, oh, yes, we have to. And so he even wrote the introduction to our book. And the reaction that we've got is very interesting. We've got people telling us, you know, I never would have picked up a book like that, but I read the first page, I laughed, I thought, these people know where I'm coming from, and I kept on reading.
So, you know, there's been a lot of studies recently that claim that if you just tell people more facts about global warming, this isn't actually going to change their mind. That there's something rooted more deeply in ideology that determines whether you buy into climate science or don't buy into climate science. So what different tack do you take in your book, besides just presenting facts, to convince your audience that this is a real problem? I mean, the intending audience, right, is conservative Christians.
Yes.
Who are, I mean, the stereotype is that they're very much anti-climate science. So what tack do you take to convince them that this is actually something they ought to care about?
Well, the tack we take is actually in the title of the book, global warming facts for faith-based decisions. The first thing we have to do before people are open to facts is we have to establish that this is an issue that is, does not run counter to our beliefs, our theology, our values, or even our ideology. So that's where we have to start. Nobody's interested in the facts if they think that it runs directly counter to their theology or their beliefs. It threatens our identity. Nobody wants to change who they are. By the time we're an adult, we like who we are. We want to keep who we are. We've made choices. We've made values. We've picked our faith or our religion. We've picked our ideology. We've picked the things we think are important. We're not looking for somebody to turn us into something we're not. So once we kind of are able to break through that barrier of, you know, I'm on this side and you're on that side. No, we're on the same side. Then that's where the facts can help.
Now, you know, I think one of the most convincing pieces of evidence regarding CO2, and maybe this is just my bias as a paleoclimatologist, but is the ice core record from Antarctica, where you see 800,000 years of cyclical variations in CO2 ranging between 180 parts per million and 280. And then suddenly you hit today and we're up at nearly 400 parts per million.
Yes.
But I've also seen you show a graph that you've created that ends 6,000 years ago. And this is specifically to talk to Christian audiences. Mm-hmm. Do you think that showing these graphs is in some ways not as useful, that if people can't understand the full cycle back at least a million years, that they can't understand what's going on about climate change? Or is it more that not fighting this argument allows people to see another moral and ethical argument that Christianity presents to deal with climate change?
That is a great question. And I have had many people kind of push back at me with that. But here's the thing. With the issue of climate change, we do not have the luxury of time to all come to agreement on the age of the earth or the process of evolution or creation before we take action on climate change. We have to put in place reasonable policies to begin to reduce our emissions, which would help us to stabilize eventually carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere. We have to do that within a matter of years. The longer we delay, the higher the risk of dangerous consequences. The further down the path we go, the more risk we acquire. It's kind of like there's no magic number of cigarettes you have to smoke before you get lung cancer, but you know that the more cigarettes you smoke, the higher the risk of lung cancer. There's no magic number of hamburgers we have to eat before we develop risk for heart disease, but the more hamburgers we eat and less vegetables, the higher the risk of heart disease. So in the same way with climate change, we are really running out of time to avoid dangerous impacts. And if we camp on the hill of science and we say everybody has to agree with us on every aspect of science before we can move forward, we are going to lose the battle. We are going to be so far down the road to dangerous climate impacts that there will be no going back. And from my perspective, the number one issue we are facing right now is the issue of climate change. And to understand the reality of climate change, the fact that humans are the ones responsible for our current change and we're feeling the impacts right now, we don't have to think the world is any older than 300 years. That is all we have to agree on, because when you look at the CO2 record over the last, 6,000 years, the rise following the Industrial Revolution is actually, I think, even more powerful, because you're looking at just this flat plateau of CO2 and then all of a sudden this just abrupt rise.
I mean,
Industrial Revolution.
It looks like the hockey stick, essentially.
Yes, but it's CO2.
Right.
Yeah, it's not temperature proxy records. It's actually measuring CO2 in the ice bubbles. So I think that it's actually even more powerful when you just look at the short term, because if you think the world is only 6,000 years old, and this is something that my husband discovered, that was another one of the issues we argue over. If you think the Earth is only 6,000 years old, then you can't argue natural cycles, because there aren't any. If you're going to argue big natural cycles, like we've seen with the last ice ages, you have to go with an Earth that's older than 6,000 years.
So, and what kind of reception do you get from conservative audiences? I mean, do they often think of you as, let's say, just a front? You're just sort of fronting a conservative image or a Christian image, or do they buy that, but they don't necessarily buy your message about climate change? I mean, what kind of reception do you get from conservative audiences?
Well, it totally divides down a line of whether they've actually met me and listened to me speak or read the book or not. So if it's somebody who just saw one quote from me in the newspaper or one 30-second clip from me on TV, then those type of people tend to judge me the way you said, like, oh, you're just kind of mouthing the words. You don't really hold to any of these values. You've sold out to Al Gore, you don't really worship God. You worship Al Gore, and you worship the earth kind of right. thing. And there's also a fair amount of misogynistic emails and stuff. I get a lot of my emails kind of have a tone of, you know, if you just go back to the kitchen, we wouldn't have the problems we have in the world today and stuff like that. But on the other hand, if I have a chance to talk to people and just spend, you know, 30, 45 minutes talking to them or with them, then the responses I've gotten, the most negative response I've gotten from all but a few people, there's always, you know, some people who don't listen to a word you say. They're just there to yell. That always happens. But I get responses along the lines of, well, you know what? I didn't think climate change was real. You've answered all my arguments. And if I'm going to keep on thinking it's not real, I'm going to have to find new reasons. And, you know, that's the best I can do. Right. And this past year, about a year ago now, when I was in one of those periods that come up periodically when you're getting really attacked in the media and blogs and emails and stuff, during the height of that time last year, I got an email from a man who belongs to the Society of Professional Earth Scientists, which is mostly petroleum geologists in Texas. And I had come to speak to their group a while ago, very difficult group because I would say 90% of them thought that I was talking sheer nonsense. And so I got this email from this man who said, I still don't agree with you on the issue of climate change, but we had a great dialogue. You were very respectful. You don't deserve anything that's happening to you. I just wanted to send you this email of support because you don't deserve this. This isn't the way we should be talking to each other.
And I mean, another interesting thing about you is that you're an atmospheric scientist in the political science department at Texas Tech. So what, I mean, I know you do fantastic science, but do you also do a lot of political science work, or are you more integrated with your colleagues in political science?
Well, climate change is a very political science, especially in Texas. Right. So I originally started off in the Department of Geosciences, which is more of a traditional earth sciences department. And I just transitioned, I guess it's been about a year and a half since I transitioned to political science. So by moving departments, I have this incredible freedom to pursue both the hardcore science, which I love, but also to pursue research in how people perceive and use the science, because climate science matters. It matters to decisions that are being made today. This is information that has to be used. And as scientists, if we don't think about how our information can provide input to these decisions that affect our lives, our children's lives, our neighbors, our families, the places where we live, I feel like we're shirking our responsibility.
Now, before we finish, I want to make sure I ask a question about the Anthropocene.
Oh, yeah. That is the name of the show, right?
The name of the show, yeah. Okay. And I'm curious, especially with your perspective as a scientist and a Christian, is there anything in the Bible that would allow you to say whether the Anthropocene exists or where the boundary exists? For instance, when I think of the Bible, I think...
Wow, hard question. Yeah,
maybe I should give you some time to think about this. But, you know, does Adam and Eve represent the beginning of the Anthropocene? I mean, before Adam and Eve, you have this paradise, and since then you have the concept of original sin.
Yeah.
And, you know, in the Bible, is there this concept of the Anthropocene?
Wow, that's really cool. I always think as a climate scientist, you know, I study regional climate change, so I always think of the Anthropocene as, you know, when humans kind of took over the driver's seat, when they kicked natural cycles out of the driver's seat as the main controller. But you're right, from the perspective of Christian theology, the world was actually a radically different place before Adam and Eve made a choice. And interestingly, the choice they made was not a choice for evil over good. That wasn't the choice they made. There was the one tree they were not supposed to eat from, and it was the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. So what they did was they wanted to be able to know what was right and wrong. And because of their desire to know that, that was what led to the fall. So it's interesting because we are now burdened with this morality, essentially, which was traditionally came from that source. So our sense of right and wrong comes from kind of is kind of almost like a curse in biblical terms. So yes, I think from that perspective that we've been living in the world where we have the ability to pick right from wrong, and we have the responsibility to do so. If you look through the rest of the Bible, there's all these verses about how you reap what you sow. There are consequences to choices. Everything is permissible, but not everything's beneficial to us. So it is clear as day that we have the ability to make choices, and we can make good choices and reap the benefits. We can make poor choices and reap the consequences. We can do so even when we don't know what we're doing. Because during the Industrial Revolution, did we know that all of this new energy use was going to cause climate change? No, they had no idea back then. But it wasn't until the late 1800s, till we really figured out that we could alter the the atmosphere of the planet. So we had, you know, a good 150, 200 years where we're doing this without knowing what we're doing. But that doesn't mean the consequences aren't real. They're very real. And so I think that that gets to the issue of, is there any theological or moral reason why climate change couldn't be real? Absolutely not. In fact, every theology of every major world religion tells us that we have responsibilities and that we bear consequences of our actions. So I think, again, kind of reverting to where we started from, there's so much that we do agree on. And if we could just identify what we do agree on, I think we could then identify some pathways to move forward.
And so for the last question, before we wrap up, you've done at least as much climate science communication as anyone has, and particularly to some very non-traditional audiences that maybe scientists don't typically try and engage. And so I'm wondering, you know, are you optimistic about convincing the majority of Americans, or even 90% of Americans, that this really is a problem that can be done, and not just optimistic about convincing them, but convincing them in a time frame that makes sense for action?
Well, I have to be optimistic, or else I would just kind of quit now, you know? Like, you have to have hope, otherwise you just don't, you want to keep on going. I am optimistic. I don't know if we have to do 90, but, you know, I'd be happy with 70 or 80.
Mm-hmm.
I think we can, because we all have values that tell us that this is an important thing to do. We all have these values already in us, values about caring for our children, our economy, our families, the places where we live. If we believe God created the earth and gave us the responsibility to care for it, if we believe we're told to love other people and care for our neighbors, the values are already there. I feel like the missing piece is connecting those values to action. And that, I think, is a very different perspective than the one we often think of, which is that, oh, we have this set of values, but these other people have this totally foreign set of values that would never want them. They just want to kind of, you know, rape and pillage the earth and we all go to hell in a handbasket. That's actually not the way people think, most people. And so I think that we all have good hearts. We all want to do the right thing. And if we could somehow harness that desire to do the right thing, I think we could.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to sit down with us today, Catherine.
It was a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Generation Anthropocene.
We want to thank Tom Hayden and Maxine Luckett for all of their behind-the-scenes work.
Special thanks to Pam Mattson, the Dean of Stanford School of Earth Sciences. And a very special thanks to Maserati for letting us use their song, Monoliths.
We also want to thank KZSU Stanford 90.1, where most but not all of our interviews are recorded.
You can find past episodes on our website, anthropocene.stanford.edu, where you can also submit a story idea of your own.
Follow our conversation on Twitter, @GenAnthropocene, or like us on Facebook.
I'm Mike Osborne.
I'm Miles Traer.
And I'm Leslie Chang.
History is accelerating, and you're a part of it too. Welcome to our new geologic age.